the majority of trade in GVCs does not happen through anonymous market interactions, and it does not happen among vertically integrated firms. It happens mostly in the context of repeated long-term relationships between firms that live not in the Econ 101 introductory courses, but in this gray area in between.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. The rapid spread of global value chains has revolutionized the manufacture and supply of everything. We can point to trade statistics to show that, but what aspects of the relationships between producers and buyers aren't captured in these statistics? What can we learn from those dimensions about how to build fairer, more sustainable relationships in future? Long-time observers of global value chains, Giulia Cahalgrossi of the Graduate Institute in Geneva and Rocco Machiavello of the London School of Economics are two of the authors of a study of how supply chains really work into industries, and they join me now. Giulia, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having us.
And hi, Rocco.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having us.
So first of all, how important are global value chains as drivers of development?
We would say very important.
Yeah.
But quantifications of the overall impact of GVCs on development are hard, in part because GVCs can affect development in many ways, and some of which we cannot measure very well with the data that we typically have at hand. But as far as existing quantifications go, we can say a few things. One is that GVCs currently account for over 50% of global trade, and this is essentially a result of the acceleration of production fragmentation across borders that started in the early 90s and continue over the last few decades with a small slowdown in recent years. But in parallel with this process of fragmentation of production across borders, developing countries have expanded their participation in GVCs, and they saw higher growth and reductions in their poverty rates. Recent report from the World Bank estimates that 1% increase in GVC participation increases income per capita by more than 1%. And this is twice as much as the estimated impact of conventional trade on income per capita. This outperforming of GVCs over regular trade in terms of delivering on poverty reduction comes from developing countries transitioning out of commodities and into basic manufacturing and activities of a higher value addition, but also in the pulling from employment and from the demand of intermediate inputs that can give a further boost to private sector development. And then obviously technology transfers and the passing of know-how shared between buyers and suppliers across borders also play a big, big role. So again, quantifications are a little bit elusive, but at least qualitative, I think there is widespread consensus that GVCs have played a very big role in the reduction of poverty across the developing world.
In this paper that you've written, which is an investigation into how this works, you picked two industries, garments and coffee. Why these two?
We have picked these two industries because we have been working in these two industries for over 10 years. So the question is, why did we work for over 10 years on these two industries? And when we started this agenda, we were very much inspired by the work that sociologists were doing when studying global value chains, particularly in reference to developing countries. So I'm thinking about the work of Gary Jareffi, for instance, and others. The sociologists were talking about things that didn't really appear necessarily in the economics textbook or in the graduate PhD syllabus courses that we were seeing in our departments. So we essentially looked for two stereotypical global value chains of the kind that the sociology literature sometimes calls buyer-driven. So these tend to be value chains in which productions happen in the global south, mostly done by the poorer segments of societies often, and then consumption takes place in northern richer countries. And we were looking for two stereotypical examples, one from manufacturing and one from agriculture. We wanted two different examples because we felt that, of course, the two wide groups are going to be very different. But once you take an organizational perspective, focusing on the governance, on the way business is done, actually, we felt that having an example from each of manufacturing and agriculture would also highlight similarities and not just differences. So we picked garments and coffee. So we just talked about the rise of global value chains and their importance for development. Garments is often has been associated with the early phases of industrialization and structural transformation. So this is true if you see countries in the West, but also countries more recently in East Asia. Garments played a very important role, along a few other industries, in starting that journey that then creates manufacturing powerhouses. It's possible that this is the case because it's a very labor-intensive industry, the final stage of the garment value chain, and there are four countries that have abundant and cheap labor have some kind of recurring comparative advantage in the production of these garments. But at the same time, garments is produced in much larger factories than the production units that are typically observed in developing countries where there are very few large firms. Garments is like a gymnasium, if you like, where countries learn how to do manufacturing at international standards. And then they can move on and apply this, having learned management practices in garments, and maybe they can apply them in light electronics or in cars and in other things. Garments has also intrinsic relevance because of its social role in many of these countries. In many countries that produce garments, the vast majority of the employees are women, and therefore, in countries like, say, Bangladesh and other in Southeast Asia particularly, but also if you look at the historical experience in Western Europe and in North America, garments have played a very important role also in generating work opportunities outside the home for women, and therefore has been an engine not just of economic transformation, but also of socioeconomic transformation. So coffee, instead, we were looking for an agricultural chain. And there, agricultural chains are incredibly fragmented often. And therefore, we were looking for a chain in which you had many smallholders. And at the same time, it was an export-oriented chain so that we could track what happens after the farm gate, essentially. And yeah, coffee gives a fantastic example of that. There are over 25 million smallholder farmers around the world. It's, until recently, after oil, the most valued traded commodity in the world. Demand is still increasing. And so it's a sector that allow us to potentially also do some comparative work by looking at how it works across different countries. We know that these two chains are special. For instance, even within manufacturing, you know, once you start working on it, you realize that garments is very different from footwear. Coffee is very different from cocoa. But still, we hope that having picked these two kind of laboratories, if you like, allow us to highlight some features that we think are actually common to many of the other chains, although they might appear in slightly different form. And more importantly, features that are actually common across these two types of chains. So a big theme, I think, that we try to develop in the paper is this idea that although in garments it is mostly workers that, of course, are employed, and in coffee instead is smallholder farms, and therefore these are two very different organizational forms, there are many analogies between the two and many common lessons that we can draw.
It might surprise some people, considering the importance of GVCs, that the contracts that stand behind them are incomplete. And what does this mean? It sounds a bit scary.
Economists, when they refer to incomplete contracts, they refer to situations in which parties can't write enforceable contracts that specified what should happen in every possible circumstance. And a moment of self-reflection then immediately suggests that incomplete contracts are a fact of commercial life, in the sense that unforeseen contingencies arise every day for every business. Now, even when parties do write these extremely complex contracts, and you can think, for instance, some contracts I've seen in the oil and gas exploration and exploitation industry as hundreds of pages long. So these are incredibly sophisticated and complex documents. Even when parties write that, they know that the contract can't possibly cover all things that could happen over the course of a long-term relationship, which is often what is needed for this very complex product. Even when contracts are not perfectly enforceable in this sense, they serve other important purposes. Because when an unforeseen contingency happens, so it's something that we didn't exactly agree before on what we should be doing, then we are going to behave, or we're going to have expectations about what each of us in this relationship is supposed to be doing in this particular case that was not covered by the contract. And very often drafting the contract helps parties build this clarity of expectation, this shared understanding of what is supposed to happen when something unexpected happens. And, you know, of course, you can think of this as a in a microcosm as the culture of that relationship. And now, of course, the culture of that relationship is embedded in a bigger form of culture, which is the culture in society, which also provides guidance on how people are expected to behave when unexpected things happen. And so, for example, I remember one flower exporter say, yes, of course, we do write contracts with our buyers so that then we don't need them later on. And so what he really meant was this idea that they write things down, they take time to negotiate, not because they think that they can take any of these to court, but really to clarify their expectation in the relationship. Now, when contracts are incomplete, and this is a message that the early organizational scholars from von Hayek to Bernard to Williamson has pointed out, the key problem that emerges is one of adaptation. How to respond, what to do when these unforeseen contingencies arise. The main lesson is that prices, which are the exclusive focus of what we teach in Microeconomics 101, are not sufficient to understand how parties deal with the adaptation problem.
Talking about insufficient data, we have a lot of trade statistics. I have spent many hours behind this microphone interviewing your colleagues about what they do tell us. But what is it important to know about GVCs that we cannot understand through trade statistics?
No, that's exactly right. So we have richer and richer data in the form of customs records, VAT records that characterize transactions between firms inside of a country, employer-employee match data. So a host of sources of data that allowed us to characterize better not only the direct participation in GVC, so the direct engagement of a firm with import and export activities embedded in a supply chain, but also indirect participation of firms and workers that are connected through supply linkages to other firms that participate directly in GVCs. But as rich as this data is, because it's typically based on administrative records, it misses the informal sector that can be particularly large in developing countries. So this is smallholder farmers, micro enterprises, the self-employed. Another important limitation is that what we see in the data is at best prices and quantities in firm-to-firm transactions. From a development perspective, this misses an important dimension of trade that boils down to the nature of relationships between firms. So the majority of trade in GVCs does not happen through anonymous market interactions, and it does not happen among vertically integrated firms. It happens mostly in the context of repeated long-term relationships between firms that live not in the Econ 101 introductory courses that Rocco was talking about, but in this gray area in between. So beyond how much we trade and what price we set, what are the implicit agreements that we make with each other about our current exchanges and also our future interactions? And it is on those agreements that these relationships are sustained and living between these anonymous markets and intra-firm trade. And coming back to Rocco's earlier point, these agreements are extremely context-specific.
If the trade statistics aren't telling us everything that, well, you want to know, how do you fill in those gaps? What evidence do you use?
Mostly with surveys, with being in the field and doing focus groups and talking to the actors in these supply chains. But in addition, and a lot of the work that we do together relies on internal company records and the very close collaboration with international buyers in supply chains, but also with manufacturers in developing countries that serve in these supply relationships. And here is where really focusing on specific supply chains matters a lot, because on the researcher's side, you need this inside knowledge of the context and of the supply chain to understand what to look for and what to look at, but also you need that inside knowledge to get the credibility and the players' trust in order to access companies' internal records, to talk to workers and elicit valuable and truthful information.
So as we were discussing with incomplete contracts, it's comparatively straightforward to contract for quantity, but not so easy to contract for quality. From your experience, how in these relationships is quality measured and delivered?
So from a kind of trade statistics point of view, physical aspects of the product are specified using a standardized, harmonized system of product codes. For example, in garments, this would look like men's shirt made of cotton. So not particularly informative. But of course, buyers and sellers build a much more detailed common understanding of what is being traded. For example, in coffee, this can include the quality grade based on the size of the coffee beans, the rate of defects that the buyer is going to accept, concept and perhaps some certifications, fair trade and things like this. On the garment side, this could be based on samples that are assessed beforehand. This could also include some quota on quality defects, but it can be super specific shades and color specifications of the use of chemicals and even social compliance norms that the buyer wants you to adhere to when you're producing products for them. And a benign interpretation of this is that all of these are things that are potentially observable to the buyer exposed. So when the buyer receives the shipments of the goods, but are non-contractable in the sense that if we end up at this dispute on any quality dimension, it would be very difficult for a court to apportion responsibilities to parties in an effective manner. So this comes back to the point of contracting completeness. So even if we understand what quality is and what we expect from each other in terms of quality, it's going to be impossible for us to write this down and account for every possible contingency that may arise in the context of our relationship. But even if we do, if we have a fallout on some quality point, it's going to be very hard to deal with that in a court of law, in an effective, in a cost-effective manner. And this is in part one of the reasons why parties having long-standing relationships and a common understanding and trust for each party doing what they are supposed to do plays such an important role.
There is a large amount of money changing hands in these relationships. Is there evidence that foreign buyers are using finance creatively to improve these relationships?
Yes, foreign buyers in this type of chains play a crucial role in financing trade potentially. Finance is really when someone gives money to someone else to do something and then be paid back at a later date. And what is special about money is the fact that money is not special. So money is completely fungible. So if I give you money to do something, it's very easy for you to use it to do something else that you were not intended to do. And presumably you are borrowing this money to do something that will take time to pay off. And it's risky. And therefore, money is the perfect excuse to say, well, it didn't work out and that's why I'm not paying you back. So the finance is really where even very relatively simple or trivial transactions bring to the fore, to the light, the importance of enforcement. The problem when you study the type of chain we are studying is that the institutional environment, broadly defined, is weaker in the producing countries, and therefore producer will be at a disadvantage in financing their operation. In addition, when you think about financing trade, trade takes longer time. Trade is riskier, and therefore, this disadvantage that producers in developing countries have to finance their operation is particularly biting when you're thinking about exporting. What we see both in coffee and garments is that these are industries that have enormous working capital requirements. There are, of course, also fixed assets investments, but I'm going to focus on the working capital problem, so financing the working capital. And these requirements are very large. So, you know, if you are a garment manufacturer, you need to use fabric, and fabric is about 60 to 70% of your overall cost. And you need to pay the fabric before you actually export the garments and then later be paid. So how do you finance that? If you're exporting coffee, you need to buy coffee from farmers during harvest. And that's about 80% of your revenue. So you, in the space of a few months, a small enterprise in rural areas need to fund 80% of their annual cash. They need to come up with that kind of working capital. These are enormous problems for these firms. Buyers play a role because they can create collateral. Now, of course, there is one trivial way in which buyers can play a role, is that they provide finance. So in both chains, there are several examples of, if you do cut, make, and trim type of system, so not FOB type of exports in garments, the buyer will procure all the material and then simply give the material to the exporter. That's a way to solve the working capital problem for the exporter. They just need to finance the working capital, which is required to pay workers, which is a relatively minor share of the sales. And so that enormously reduced the working capital problem, and the buyer essentially absorbed that. Sometimes in agricultural chains like coffee, you have buyers that advance funds. So, you know, I'm now asking you to commit or, you know, to promise that you will deliver coffee in 6 months' time after harvest and processing, but I already advanced maybe 40% of the required funds, 50% so that you can purchase coffee. So one direct way in which buyers do it is that themselves, these are larger company borrowing in better markets, they provide working capital. Now, of course, when they do so, you have to be very careful because you need to trust the exporter again to whom you are providing finance. Other times, buyers become very important because they generate the collateral based upon which exporters themselves can access finance. So for instance, in garments, when you look at Bangladesh, one of the less well-written stories, perhaps, about the tremendous success of the garment industry in Bangladesh has been the financial arrangement in place in the industry. So it is true, of course, that Bangladesh has very low wages, and that's what created the initial comparative advantage. But the central bank essentially established a back-to-back credit facility whereby, based on the orders that companies would have from foreign buyers, the exporter could then open a letter of credit vis-a-vis foreign exporter that would then deliver the fabric. And so, in other words, you use an order or a letter of credit that you have with the buyer in order to open another letter of credit that allows you to finance more smoothly the importing of fabric. And what that has allowed the industries essentially is to completely develop on a FOB system, which is very good because it allows the exporter to gain more control over more stages of production or more value added and be more involved in the commercial aspect of the industry relative to a system in which the buyer simply provides the fabric and then gets back the fabric stitched in some garments. In coffee, what very often the forward contracts at for a physical coffee that the buyer contract with the exporter, so these promises of saying you'll deliver two containers of coffee like in 6 months or one container of coffee in 6 months, these contracts, which often take the form of letter of intent more than contract because the environment is so volatile, are often used by companies to borrow money from lenders who issue working capital loans based on these promises. And there are models, for instance, you know, the root capital model, that very often the lender will try to have a direct relationship with the buyer, so that then at the time the coffee is delivered, it's the buyer that directly repays the lender. And again, that helps tremendously in creating collateral and relaxing financial constraints for this exporter. So yes, buyers play absolutely a crucial role in solving the finance problem. And the finance problem is particularly severe for this type of exporters in developing countries.
Implicit in everything that you say here are concepts like flexibility and reliability. Can they easily be communicated or contracted in advance for these relationships?
Yeah, flexibility and reliability are the two main issues that when I talk, especially to buyers, but also to exporters, pop up in conversation as really the tricky one to achieve. So by reliability, we mean the confidence that the buyer has in the fact that the supplier will deliver the goods, the product, as agreed, pretty much no matter what. Emerging markets, they suffer a lot of shocks. There's all sorts of hiccups. You know, if you are in an economy where there's frequent protest or, you know, the customs officials are very slow and so forth, it's going to be very hard, for instance, to do just in time. And it takes a lot of preparation for these exporting firms to make sure that they meet the deadlines. But reliability really refers to these expectations somehow that I will get the goods as planned, when planned, pretty much no matter what. And that will often mean that the exporter needs to take significant effort to spend significant resources for which he or she is not going to be directly compensated, because these are resources that cannot be written down in a contract.
Yes.
For obvious reason, partly is to respond to unforeseen contingency and partly is to avoid moral hazard or incentive issues. And therefore, the exporter will be expected to take actions to go beyond the call of duty very often. And that's what we mean by reliability. And flexibility is something similar. It is more referred to similar actions that are required from the exporter, but on the demand of the buyer. Because the buyer, of course, also faces shocks. And in particular, the buyer faces shocks to demand. Sometimes they will need some bit more production than what was agreed before. Sometimes they will need a different type of production. Sometimes they will need a different delivery place. Being a reliable and flexible exporter then means that, again, when these unforeseen contingency and unforeseen requests that are very valuable for the buyer come, then does the buyer have the confidence that the exporter will step up? So, for instance, I remember once talking again with the buyer of flowers. We had surveyed this fantastic company in Kenya, was foreign-owned, and the owner was an incredibly charming lady. Everybody loved her in the industry, clearly. And the only negative thing that we heard about her was a buyer that said, yeah, she's absolutely fantastic, but she always commits so much of her production in advance that if you need a little bit more, she's never able to deliver it to you. And right. That was exactly this notion of saying, yeah, you know, on the flexibility side, she couldn't provide it. And obviously, you can't solve that with prices. You can't simply say, oh, you know, if I need a bit more, let me pay you a little bit more. Because the reality is that, first of all, it's not nice to constantly negotiate prices, because the price negotiation is always a zero sum. So you do it once and you try not to do it constantly. The second is that also creates problems, right? Because then, you know, why is it that you are willing to pay more when you have a problem, but not when I have a problem and I need to compensate? We shouldn't think that these issues can simply be solved by paying higher contingent prices when this shock arrives. Typically, you solve them by creating value that is kind of more stable in the relationship. So, for instance, paying slightly permanently higher prices, then the exporter earns a little bit higher margins. And therefore, when they need to choose who to prioritize, they might be more willing to prioritize the buyer that pays these higher prices on average. Another way to create value is from the buyer perspective is to give plans very much in advance and to guarantee sufficient capacity utilization. That's also good because, you know, the exporter cares both about the price and the cost. And having that guaranteed capacity utilization is very good for planning, is very good for more efficient utilization and therefore for cost. So in our experience, these are kind of the dimensions that are then used essentially to purchase reliability and flexibility in these type of markets.
These markets are very competitive. There's a lot of people buying, there's a lot of people selling, but everything that you're talking to me about relies on stable, long-term relationships. As an economist, you might wonder why these relationships don't break up more often.
That's right. And in the settings that we study and that we document in the paper, about 70% of the trade happens in the context of these long-term relationships and the rest is spot market transactions. So they do coexist. And earlier we talked about quality and reliability and flexibility. So there are many aspects of these trade exchanges that are non-contractable. And what this means in practice is that they are subject to opportunistic behavior. So they may be a point in time in our relationship where one of the two parties is going to have some temptation to deviate from the implicit agreement they've made to the other side of the deal. So, for example, this could be a coffee exporter that at some point finds it potentially profitable not to honor a contract with a buyer at a pre-agreed price and instead to side sell to another buyer that at that point in time is offering a better deal. In the context of garments, this could be that in a bottleneck of production, the manufacturer has workers working beyond allowable overtime in order to deliver to a buyer, despite this being prohibited according to the code of conduct of that buyer. And in any of these examples of deviations, there will be no market or no court recourse that prevents this from happening by the arguments we made earlier. So there needs to be a sufficient incentive for both parties to adhere to this agreement so trade can take place. And those incentives are going to come from somewhere, and they will come from the fact that we both value the continuation of our relationship. And this can come in the form of the promise of future trade, of demand assurance and capacity utilization, but it can also come from rents and buyers paying a higher margin or a higher markup to their supplier because I need to be able to promise you a transfer that is sufficiently high such that our relationship is more valuable to you than trading on the spot market and deviating from our agreement more broadly. So this is how relationships are sustained by rents arise. And as you pointed out, the interesting thing is that they coexist with spot transactions as well. And this is because in practice, markets are not perfectly competitive and allow for an array of organizational forms in a world that in practice hosts companies that are very different in their internal structure as well. Not all companies can support relational contracting because in the same way that relational contracting is rooted in specificities of the buyer-seller relationship, it does require a set of capabilities of parties to deliver a clear message of what is needed, but also a credible promise for honoring all of these implicit agreements.
We know that a lot of foreign buyers have market power. Is there evidence in global value chains that this power disadvantages local producers?
There is much talking about market power in this type of chains. I would say that the evidence is a little bit thinner than we would like to. So first of all, even measures of concentration on the buyer side are not so easy to measure specifically in these chains. What we have seen, at least at the export gate, is that for the case of garments, you have many, many producers. You also have many, many, many buyers. Now, it is true that some buyers are disproportionately larger than producers. But some producers from developing countries now are becoming very, very large groups that own factories and facilities across different countries. This just to say that in garments, the question of market power at the export gate is a very complex one, and it's not simply, the large buyers call all the shot at this point. In the case of coffee, what we are seeing at the export gate is that very often the exporting side is more concentrated than the buying side. So what that to me suggests is that at least an important problem of market power in the coffee chain, there might be an issue with market power at the global level in the global market, but a lot of problem of market power arises in the domestic part of the chain. So in other words, the exporters having a lot of powers over the farmers as opposed to the foreign buyers directly. Now, of course, the two things are intertwined because a lot of the large exporters are companies that are also involved in buying and in trading. And therefore, an accurate measurement of market power there is a little bit trickier than the usual sort of bilateral oligopoly or market with monopsony power that we write down. Challenge one, the data. Challenge two, actually, when you look at the identities of these firms, things are not as simple as we would maybe read in some sort of report or journalistic account. Mm-hmm. Challenge number three, there is market power in every market because there is differentiation. The question is what generates differentiation, what allows these companies to exercise market power? And there I think that sometime even economists, they don't necessarily deploy all the machinery that industrial organization economists have developed to think a little bit about differentiation. I'm going to give concrete examples. So one way in which companies have market power over workers, if you think about the garment sector in Bangladesh, for instance, and we are seeing it in these days, might be the actual exercise of market power that comes from collusive conduct, if you like. This is really the kind of nasty market power that we should try not to have. There are, unfortunately, news in the days of protests in Dhaka and in other parts of Bangladesh of garments workers these days. And, the employer association has put out a statement that say all members shouldn't hire any new employees in these days to collude and prevent workers from walking away with their feet when they are fired as a result of protests. That's clearly a very nasty manifestation of monopsony power. But a lot of monopsony power actually maybe in practice arises from the fact that these workers, because they work so many hours and the infrastructure are so bad, they can't commute very far away. Mm-hmm. So the reason why in practice, even if there are 1,000 manufacturers, I can only work in the 3, 4, 5 that are in my town.
Yeah.
That generates market power. But it's not the market power that arises from some malicious conduct of the employer. It just comes from other sources. And in rural economies, if you think about coffee, it's the same thing. If I need to process coffee and I'm a very smallholder farmer, there are only so many mills that we can have in the rural areas to which I can take coffee. I cannot imagine that there is a competitive market for mills because there are very high transport costs. And so when differentiation comes from transport costs, other forms of amenities and so forth, then our estimate of market power, if they don't take that into account, become very misleading. And the final point is that once you take this relational perspective, some degree of market power is needed. So it could be the case that some degree of market power is what enables this valuable relationship to emerge. In the case of coffee, we have some slightly more rigorous evidence in a paper that I've done with my good friend and colleague Amit Morjaria, in which we show that too much competition between the buyers, between mills, in this case processor, tend to undermine the relationship between the processor and the farmers in a way that doesn't make the farmers better off. So it turns out that actually having an extra mill to sell makes the farmer worse off in those type of markets. Of course, in a context in which there are already many mills. So this is certainly not a rationale for monopsony regulation or the like. In the context of garments, we don't have such rigorous evidence yet. But one thing that we have done with the paper that we are discussing is to put together some facts that, again, seem to suggest that the degree of concentration in employer positively correlate with the quality of the industrial relations that the workers experience in this factory. And so that is at least in a qualitative sense, again, suggestive of the fact that maybe having few very large but well-run professional employer in the outskirts of town, these guys end up offering better workplace arrangements than the cramped but small and very competitive companies in other parts of the town. I do believe that there is market power and that is probably market power is pernicious in many cases and disadvantages producers or workers in this type of chains. Having said that, we have much less evidence even when it comes to measurement, let alone estimation, let alone estimating the causes of this market power to draw very strong policy conclusions on the moment.
But for those producers, where there are small producers, is there anything they can do to cooperate with each other to protect themselves against any potential abuse of the relationship?
Yes, there is something, but it's very, very, very hard to build, I think. Something that often pops up in this conversation is the importance of creating farmers group or maybe aggregating farmers into cooperatives. Now, cooperatives are an incredibly important organizational form. In many contexts, they have played a very important role also in rich countries. And I don't think that we have a very good understanding of cooperatives in many agricultural chains. Cooperatives are fragile organizational form because the ownership is diffused. And therefore, then you have kind of governance problems inside of the cooperative, which are not necessarily so straightforward to solve. Ownership is also diffused. And typically, cooperatives have one vote, one member, which also creates potentially inefficiency in terms of aggregate surplus because it's the median voter that decides how the COP is run as opposed to sort of some profit maximization and then with redistribution. The second thing is that when we have cooperatives, there are evidence, some nice papers in the literature, but also more anecdotal evidence that often in many environments, they end up being captured either by local elite or by politicians. So often these cooperatives don't function very well. There are, of course, examples in coffee in Latin America. I've encountered many really wonderful cooperatives that really do a great job. And in fact, I think it's fundamental, you know, the job that they do in aggregating and trying to protect the interest of the farmers. But this idealized thing doesn't happen as often as it could. In garments or in manufacturing chain, then it's not about cooperatives, it's about unions. Unions are, again, very difficult to build because there is a problem, again, of collective action that needs to be solved. So there's a problem of leadership, and very often there is a problem of repression that makes the collective action very, very costly. My view is that unionization is a necessary ingredient, or some forms of unionization. There are many different forms of unionization, but some form is really needed, I think, to move the needle and protect workers and really move these workplaces to better industrial relationships, essentially. Because unless there is a bilateral commitment power, which comes from aggregation, then it's going to be very hard, I think, to sustain very good relationship in many contexts.
If you look at it from the other end, what is that role of voluntary commitments from buyers or organizations that monitor how buyers are behaving? How important is that?
I think they are potentially very important, and they have certainly grown enormously their influence now. I think, I don't remember the latest statistics, but I think now perhaps even the majority of all coffee is traded under some kind of voluntary certification. And so they have become very important. There are a lot of initiatives in garments similarly to those. And there are a lot of people that are genuinely, I think, committed to the cause of trying to readdress a little bit the imbalances that come perhaps from market power. Having said that, the evidence about the effectiveness of these schemes, I would say, is quite scant. Maybe the best analogy I can think of is maybe a little bit a parallel with the microfinance literature, where at some point we had this promise of microfinance that would solve all problems. And once we started having more scrutiny, we realized that, of course, it's not bad on average. It helps a little bit, but it's certainly not transformative. And I think that something similar, if one wants to be generous, can be said for a lot of these schemes, taken in isolation. And the reasons are complex, but for instance, in agricultural chain, a lot is about the fact that you try to create schemes that generate market premium, but then in a competitive environment, this market premium gets sort of dissipated and sort of competed away. Because of free entry, you have a lot of over-certification. Farmers pay to certify a lot of their produce, and then they sell only a minority, maybe 20, 30, 40% of their product as certified. These voluntary standards play potentially two very important roles. One, of course, is to create awareness among consumers, and I think this is very important. And then the second one is to work together, and some do, some better than others, but to work together with the buyers. And so when this program gets embedded in the sourcing relationship, so when is the sourcing department of the buyer that works either with the voluntary standard or with other organizations to implement sustainability effort, I think that those type of situation then become very powerful. When the involvement of the buyer happens, but in a way that is disconnected from sourcing, which is definitely the case also in many buyers, there might be some impact, but I would tend to be in general a little bit more skeptical. And in any case, those are cases in which it's really a philanthropic motive. The real transformation is going to come when we're going to see a commercial case or a change in these relationships, essentially, that is commercially sustainable. And for that to happen, you really need the involvement of the sourcing teams.
During the whole of this conversation, we have talked almost exclusively about private relationships between the parties. We haven't really discussed the role of institutions at all, and they're often in low-income countries, not strong, they're not particularly active. Could stronger institutions make a difference to how these relationships function?
One way to think about it is that stronger rule of law or stronger state capacity in low-income countries, maybe in the form of more effective enforcement and more effective monitoring, reduces that space of non-contractability in trade transactions, especially on social compliance and environmental aspects of trade transactions. And when we put it this way, as stronger state capacity reduces the non-contractability problem, one may think that this means that state capacity is a substitute for relationships and for relational sourcing. But in my view, this is not the right way to think about this. From a comparative advantage point of view, and this point exists in an earlier literature, even before we were all focused on global supply chains, countries that are abundant in high quality rule of law or in high quality state capacity tend to export goods that are intensive in the use of relationship specific investments or relationship specificity. So in this sense, state capacity is not a substitute for relationships, but it's essentially a complement to all of the other solutions and tools from the side of buyers or organizations that monitor either buyers or sellers that Rocco was talking about earlier. So to me, the way to think about the relationship between state capacity and sourcing relationships is that state capacity facilitates better functioning markets and also better functioning relationships that can go deeper in terms of the understanding and the agreements that parties reach.
We've talked a lot about how these relationships tend to differ from place to place, from industry to industry, and that also there is much about them that we either don't know or is very hard to measure. Does this mean that it's very difficult to generalize in policy terms about what should be done to improve the lives of the people who work in these industries?
Yes, I think there's an enormous agenda here and a lot of progress that needs to be made. Yeah, contracting completeness is very important. Market power is important for kind of endemic reasons. You can't think that the correct benchmark is a perfectly competitive market and that these two things interact. Of course, policymakers are aware of these issues. So when you look at the producing countries, most countries actually have some kind of regulations of how their agricultural chains are organized, not just in terms of on the production side, but even on the marketing, the processing, and so forth. Almost every single country that I know of in coffee has quite intrusive regulation on the commercialization of coffee. We don't have a lot of evidence about the effects or the impact of this regulation and whether they are good or not. There are some examples, however, that we can draw from the literature that have shown that probably a policy misunderstanding of the functioning of this sector led to not great regulation. So there is, for instance, a very nice paper by Dilip Mukherjee and co-authors in the AEJ Applied that looked at the policy that the Bangladeshi government implemented in the oil seeds chain. So, you know, this is imports of oil seeds that then get refined and then produce oil. And the government was very concerned about the abuse of market power of certain intermediaries. And therefore, all of a sudden, banned those intermediaries thinking, oh, you know, you remove one step of the chain, you remove double marginalization, surely the chain is going to become more efficient. Turns out those intermediaries were the key providers of finance in the chain.
Right.
And therefore, when you remove them, the price tend to increase and price pass-through tend to decrease. And price pass-through, we tend to take it as a sign, if you like, of sort of efficiency in competitive market with constant return, you'll have a lot of pass-through. Another recent example is a beautiful paper that just came out in the AER by Michael Rubens. He looks at the tobacco sector in China, where the government essentially forced some processing firms to consolidate. And the argument was because there are large fixed costs in processing, then some kind of consolidation might lead to efficiency gain and therefore to a better market. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. What the consolidation did simply increased market power without any noticeable efficiency gain. I'm not saying that all regulations are bad. There are probably also many good regulations, and I can think of some that are particularly well designed. But yes, devil is in the detail, and poor understanding, I think, can lead to not great regulation. And in general, we don't know much about this regulation. The game changer, I think, now in this type of chain is the fact that the importing countries are starting to legislate in their trade regulations about how things that are imported should be produced in the global south at the national level. There are examples in the US, but of course, perhaps the biggest example of this is the recent EUDR regulation on deforestation. I think this is going, certainly for coffee and for the seven sectors that are involved, I think EUDR is going to be a game changer. I think it's a regulation that will have a lot of unintended consequences. And so it's just because of its complexity. And I think it's way too early to evaluate its impact. Having said that, if one looks at the details of how the regulation came about, or if you like, the lack of detail in implementations or the difficulty in implementation, you already see that probably an inadequate understanding or inadequate data about the functioning of these chains was probably created difficulties in creation of a regulation that could actually be enforced as intended. I think as importing countries move into better regulatory space by including provisions about how things that are imported are produced elsewhere, I think that we're going to have a much, much higher demand for understanding exactly how things happen on the ground.
Well, it's a very interesting piece of research into how things really work and sometimes how they could work a bit better. Thank you very much, Rocco.
Thanks, Tim.
And thank you very much, Julia, as well.
Pleasure. Thanks, Tim.
The paper is called Global Value Chains in Developing Countries, A Relational Perspective from Coffee and Garments. And the authors are Laura Boudreau, Julia Cajal-Garossi, and Rocco Machiavello. It is published in the Journal of Economic Perspectives 37, number 3, that was published in summer 2023. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You will find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the papers we feature.